Okay, well, we are going to be back in our study of the disciples. And I changed this because I'm not quite finished with John yet. So, in fact, I really haven't talked about John too much yet. Today is going to be primarily John, but I want to go back to our notes on James and John. The hard part about studying John prior to his writings is that James and John, during the time that Jesus was on earth here, seems that they were always together. You know, they're brothers. And so any comments that are made about the one usually applies to the other. So it's hard to separate them. There is one passage where John shows up in a way that we can kind of identify, here's a character quality, here's a something that's going on, but in most cases, it's just the two of them together. Just as a review, the one of the most important things to remember about the brothers together is the name that Jesus gives them, Sons of Thunder. And that tells you quite a bit, I think, in terms of their personality, or at least the way that they would have been perceived. And the fact that Jesus himself is giving them that name, that's not a nickname they earned and then he picks up on it. He claimed that name. So he's the one that is identifying them as Sons of Thunder. So that tells me that there's something unusual about them, that if they show up, they're kind of the ones in the room that everybody's going to notice in some way. And you'd think Peter would get that, and he does when he speaks, but it seems that these two are even more forceful. And especially, I would even go so far as to say zealous. That would be the word that I would use. So we looked at Luke 9 last time, and that was Luke 9, 51 to 56. I told you that Luke 9 is probably one of the most important chapters on discipleship. If you want to know about discipleship, the good and the bad examples as well. But in Luke 9, that passage, we covered it already, so I won't go there and read it again. But that is the passage where there is a village that decides, it's a Samaritan village, and they do not want to hear Jesus. And so it is James and John who say that, shall we call down fire from heaven and destroy them all? And the fact that that's even included in the Gospels tells me there was obviously something going on there in just their attitude. So, you know, if they don't accept Jesus, then we won't accept them either. But beyond that, we would rather they just all be destroyed. That would be the simple solution. So if that's James and John together, then what we need to think of is James is the older, John's the younger, but you do have them functioning together. Now, there's the first passage we will look at today is in Matthew 20, and so we're going to go there to start with. But Matthew 20, this one involves their mother. not just the two of them, but the two of them together with their mother involved. So this is chapter 20 of Matthew, verse 20. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom." That's an ambitious request. We're also going to notice how the rest of the disciples react to this, because, they probably, their father would have been the owner of the business. They would have had some status already. But for the mother to come and say, "Well, these are going to be your number one and number two people in your kingdom." That's what the request is. Jesus answered in verse 22, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" And by the way, I'll mention to you that the you here, it's shifting over to the two of them. So it's, and that's why they answer, we are able. It's not just the mother, okay? You'd think this is just a conversation between the mother and Jesus, and they're maybe back here, you know, not saying or doing anything. No, it seems that he's addressing them because they are the ones that want this. They get their mother to ask, but he is addressing them. And they answer, we are able. And he said to them, you will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. What's that? Oh, okay. Well, I can take the jacket off, I guess, but yeah. All right. So anyway, this is not even Jesus to give. It's going to be his Father. He's the one that is in charge of the kingdom. Now, notice this in verse 24, and when the 10, that's the rest of them, heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. And I must say, this is not the end of their journey together. So I can only imagine that after this event, the relationship between the rest of the disciples and them would have been quite different. But that's ambition for sure. But also the ignorance that we see in Peter and the ignorance that we see in others about what Jesus' mission actually is, even though he has told them again and again, he is going to suffer, he's going to be humiliated, he's going to die. And that is the same cross that he is asking of his disciples. He's asking them to do the same thing. But they have in their minds the kingdom, the kingdom. That's all they're thinking about. And they're thinking about kingdom in the traditional sense of that term, which is a very physical kingdom with power over all of the Gentile nations and really bringing Israel back into its status of having its own king and having its own power. So that's what they're thinking about. Jesus is teaching them. He's giving them parables. I know that sometimes those are difficult to understand, but if someone is attuned spiritually, they should be able to figure out what he's saying. But instead, all of these disciples are clueless when it comes to what he's asking. And so this bold, ambitious statement becomes a problem in terms of the prediction, because you will drink my cup. The cup is a cup of suffering. The cup is a cup of death. And yes, they will. Since we were on James and John, really the only other passage I have where James shows up or is mentioned is in Acts 12. And I'll not turn there, but I will just tell you in Acts 12, it's in the notes, that James is the first of the disciples to be martyred. And all it says in the text, this is why I'm not going to turn and read it, it just says James, the brother of John, was put to death. That's it. So what that means is that the cup that is mentioned in this passage that we just read is that cup. And John himself would suffer as well. According to church tradition, not in Scripture, he was boiled in oil, but according to Scripture, he was exiled to the island of Patmos. So he definitely went through his own suffering. So anyway, I call James' ambition turned to sacrifice because that's really all I can say about him. In fact, even when he's mentioned in Acts chapter 12, he's mentioned alongside his brother. What I think is interesting is that with Peter and Andrew, we always had this case where if Andrew is mentioned, it's always Simon Peter's brother. But if this is the old, if James is the older and John is the younger, John eventually becomes so prominent in the Christian community, probably whenever he is writing, or I don't think he had written anything by the time James dies, but still, he becomes prominent enough. And certainly by the time Luke is writing, he's very well known. So now James is known as John's brother. So John becomes the one that's more prominent. All right. Now, John is, in my opinion, of all the disciples and all of this study, the one who has the most radical transformation. We see with Peter that he has the raw materials. They're just not honed in. They're not trained. They're not where they should be, but he has the raw materials. With John, this is a radical transformation. He starts out with his brother of being very intolerant. And I'll say, based on his writings and based on a lot of these texts that I've mentioned here, in fact, it's really on, let's see, number 5, actually, under this, the importance of truth. He emphasizes truth from the very beginning of his gospel. Truth is important to him. What does truth mean? Well, truth would be doctrinal truth. But in the concept, in the context of the disciples, in the context of Jesus' ministry, Jesus is Messiah. Anyone who rejects him is rejecting the truth. And so the truth is very important to him. But what happens when you have someone who is zealous for the truth? I'm going to make a connection between John and Paul as well, even though Paul's not part of our study. Paul is a study unto himself. But from Paul's own descriptions of his past, he was zealous for the truth. This is why he rounded up Christians to kill them. Zeal for the truth. For many of us, and I've grown up in conservative Christian churches all my life, and I know that truth is like the priority. It's the highest virtue. It is, well, in the words of Jude, contend for the faith. That is the most important thing that we have. And so whatever victims come from that, contending for the truth is the most important thing. And it is a tendency for those of us in more conservative circles that we will put the truth as the highest virtue. And so here is something that John has as a characteristic. The truth above all. Those Samaritans are wrong theologically. Burn them all. Destroy them all. You have pagans who should not be a part of this because of their immorality. I mean, the Greco-Roman context, sexual perversions and violence were not just on the fringes. They weren't in some red light district. It was their society in Rome. And so how do you deal with bringing that into the church? Now, yes, your assumption is they get saved and now their lives are going to change, but they might not change immediately. But, you know, you've got the, you know, the gospel that can change and transform. But you have Paul who does this later. Paul is a Pharisee. So I think Paul and John would have gotten together quite well. We don't have any record of them, you know, prior to, you know, Paul's conversion. But Paul and John would have been connected in this sense, and that is truth above all. And it doesn't matter what pain or hurt you bring to anyone else as long as the truth gets out there. The truth matters more than anything else. The transformation is going to be radical because the intolerant one is going to be known as the apostle of love in a way that no one else will. No one talks about love more than John, but I will also tell you, no one in the Gospels talks about truth more than John. So there is some connection between truth and love together that he learned. And by the time he writes, he recognizes that you don't have to sacrifice one for the sake of the other. You actually can have both. But at this point in his life, that's not the case. Let me take the one passage where he is by himself, okay? And that's going to be in Mark chapter 9, So in Mark chapter 9, some suggest that Peter was a major source for Mark as well. We don't always know these things because the texts don't give you footnotes or any of that sort of thing. The ancient texts don't. But we're going to go down to verse 38. Now, we've seen this before, but I want to get it from this perspective, too. We already saw this text, okay? You saw it in Luke. I told you Luke 9 is the place where we have all of these discipleship issues. But I want you to notice that Mark is the one that singles it out. He says, John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." Now, there's zeal, and there is definitely attention to the truth. This is not our group. Now, it might be also the issue that the people who are not part of our group shouldn't be doing anything that's connected to our group. That's a major issue as well. I could just tell you about my past of what I grew up in what were called fundamentalist churches. So we didn't go to movies. We didn't do all sorts of things, like all kinds of legalism that came in alongside contend for the faith. And it was a good movement in terms of being against modernism, because modernism was a major problem. You had churches that were not even believing scripture. They didn't have the right theology, that sort of thing. But it seemed that for these churches, everything was about the fight. The fight was everything. You fight against those who do not believe like us. And so you wouldn't even entertain talking to anyone in those contexts. I mean, it was that kind of strictness. In fact, they even had a thing that they would call, well, when I went to the college I went to, first degree separation, second degree separation, third degree separation. You know, to come out from among them and be separate. First degree separation is, I don't talk to a liberal. Second degree separation is, I don't talk to anyone who does talk to liberals. Third degree separation is, well, you can imagine, it goes that far. Billy Graham was evil, not for a lot of the reasons that you might not agree with him, but it was because he would talk to other groups. Well, but he would talk to other groups at churches and all, you know, like the liberal Methodists over there or the Roman Catholics. I remember he came to Notre Dame and there were all kinds of protests from the fundamentalists about him speaking at Notre Dame, you know, in the stadium. What's that? Oh, yeah. No, he invited people of all kinds of ethnic, cultural. He had this radical idea that the gospel's for everyone. So, yes, there was that sort of thing. But they used to refer to it as ecumenical evangelism. You know, it was you're trying to witness to those who are in the modernist camp or the liberal camp. Thing is, by the time I was growing up, the modernist churches were dying, because they didn't have anything to offer. I mean, that was really the bottom line. Back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, they were strong because people were trying to get away from, you know, the conservative Christianity. But the liberal churches weren't holding their own because people were going there and you had pastors who genuinely didn't even believe there was a heaven. So what in the world are you going to talk to people about? Reader's Digest or something, you know, that's what I used to call them, Reader's Digest churches or sermons. But anyway, so all of that to say that John fits into this category of the fight is everything, the contending for the truth. The truth is the most important thing. So how can you take somebody with that strong of an opinion and here's the critical term. This was the other word in growing up in these churches that they always would bring up. If you are anything other than fighting for the truth, then you are compromising. To show compassion is to be compromising. That was the idea. If I show compassion to somebody who has a different lifestyle than something that I'm in agreement with, and certainly I have strong opinions about morality, but I want to help them because they're homeless or they're lacking food, or that I want to talk with them about Jesus, you know, that sort of thing, that would be a category of compromise. I had this happen actually when I first started coming to this church, because we still had those elements at Dallas Seminary of, you know, don't compromise, don't talk to other groups, all of that. And so what I did is when I started coming here, first of all, some people were like, Presbyterian, oh my, aren't they all liberal? You know, that was the first thing. The second thing was when we had the West Dallas, we started that, the West Dallas ministry, and that it was in poor communities with churches, generally African-American churches. They weren't always all Presbyterian either, or Baptist, or Bible church, or whatever, but the issue was to try to help these communities. I just remember a lot of my friends, that's social gospel. That's all that is. And what social gospel is that the gospel is helping people. It's not the gospel as we know it. So they said, well, you're in a liberal church. You just need to get out of that church. And and so I definitely know the feeling of that strong idea, you know, the truth is more important than anything else. Okay, I think I've said enough about that, and many of you know enough about, you know, those contexts if you've been around Christians long enough. Here's the thing. There's a section in John that is unique to John, which shouldn't surprise us. He has a lot of unique things in his gospel. But there is a section that is highlighted. If I were going to take his 21 chapters and say what section gets a lot of attention, it's the upper room discourse, the upper room with Jesus and the disciples. It's chapters 13 through 17. And you think, if this is the life of Christ, essentially, leading into his ministry, a three-year ministry, and you have 21 chapters and 13 through 17 is one evening, that's it? That means he's putting a lot of emphasis on that. Luke emphasizes the journey to Jerusalem more than any other, but John is going to focus on what Jesus said. And really, there are three major chapters in that, 13, 15, and 17. What's interesting is that 17 is the high priestly prayer. So it's Jesus' prayer to his Father, which John records. So somehow John knows what he said. But that's a very important text. But what I want to do is to look at 13 and 15, not the whole chapters, obviously. We don't have that kind of time. But chapter 13, what I'd like to do is to look at starting in verse 21. So if you go to John 13, and really I want us to see the whole text together. Okay, because here's something that demonstrates the transformation of John. I want you to pay attention to the texts that deal with love, but I also want you to pay attention to the texts that deal with truth, because that will be there too. They're both there, all right? Chapter 13, verse 21, after saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved. Now, we'll come back to that phrase, because some people take that as an arrogant phrase. I do not believe it's arrogant in any sense of the term. In fact, I think the transformation comes about this way, and I do get emotional with this, because I know the transformation. It's the recognition of how much God loves him. That's what transforms him to love others. That's the only way it's possible, actually. I cannot love the unlovable until I recognize that I'm the unlovable and that God loved me. So anyway, the disciple whom Jesus loved, he's speaking of himself, was reclining at table at Jesus' side. So Simon Peter, this is always an interesting dynamic, Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. You know, this is the one time Simon Peter's quiet. I'm not asking, you ask, all right? So he's persuading John to ask Jesus. So that disciple leaning back against Jesus, this is where you get the Da Vinci picture, you know, with the leaning on Jesus. They always talk about the leaning on his shoulder like he's just there the whole time. No, here, he's just leaning back so that he's only talking to Jesus. He's not, no one else can hear it. And they're at a table where that would be difficult to do. So he leaned against Jesus and said to him, Lord, who is it? And Jesus answered, it is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it. So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Now, we'll come back to Judas later, but that happens right then. And if John is just in a private conversation with Jesus, he's the first to see exactly what's taking place, and he knows who it is. Now, in John's gospel, he is going to remind us, we knew he was a thief from the beginning, stealing from the money bag and that sort of thing. But it's one thing to be a thief, taking the money. It's another thing to be the traitor. I mean, that's more extreme. So then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, what you're going to do, do it quickly. Now, no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Even John wouldn't have known the details. He wouldn't have known how the betrayal would take place. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, buy what we need for a feast, or that he should give something to the poor. Now, John would have known that's not what he was talking about, but the rest of them, you know, just says, well, go on, Judas, you know. And from this point forward, Judas is not going to be there anymore. So all the words that are spoken from that point forward are going to be just the 11. And so keep that in mind, because I've had people ask me, well, if Judas is hearing all of these things, you know, love one another and all this, that he's not hearing all those things. He's gone before the inner circle really comes into play, the ones who are true to Jesus. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. When he had gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. Now, glory and glorification just means to kind of raise up, exalt. It's actually a word that means weighty in Hebrew, but significance. The glory of God, yes, it has a physical manifestation in the Old Testament with something bright and shining, but it really has to do with one's, I'll use C.S. Lewis's words, reputation. I know that sounds trite to us, but it really means who someone is and how they're perceived to be. So the glorification is something that's usually made public, or something that's not just a private thing. It's something where everyone knows. Little children, yet a little while I am with you, you will seek me, and just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. Now here are the words, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are also to love one another. Now, a lot of people get caught up in the new commandment because all they have to do is go to the Old Testament and realize the love of your neighbor is there. And in the context of being within Israel, love one another is the command. So it's that part's not new. What's new about the command is not the command itself. And I know punctuation matters. In ESV, they're using a colon to try to indicate this, but not all of us know how colons work. But the idea is the new commandment is, just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. In other words, the newness of the command is not the command. It's the condition of humanity in sin that it is not possible for us to do that without, one, a perfect example, and two, experiencing it ourselves. So this is the newness of it. What Jesus has shown to them, what he has modeled for them, is how they are to love. So it's not the loving, it's the how. That's really how it is to be done. And what kind of how are we talking about? We're really talking about self-sacrifice. We are talking about all of those things that we had in Luke 9 with discipleship, taking up your cross, suffering humiliation for the sake of someone else, putting yourself on the low part for someone else to, so you're thinking more of someone else than you are yourself. Now, humanity has known that concept of love. I can go back to ancient literature and find stories about that, and people are always shocked by that. What makes Jesus' situation the most shocking is that he isn't just doing this for friends. A greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's true. But Jesus had a greater one, laying down his life for his enemies. That is the shocker. And that is something you will not find anywhere else. In fact, that would be a problem if I am sacrificing myself for an enemy, for someone who actually wants the worst for me. But that's precisely what Jesus is doing. And if we read Paul's words carefully enough, we find out that we were all enemies. And his love did not extend when we changed from enemy to friend. We changed from enemy to friend because of the love that he showed us. He actually loves us when we're enemies. So, anyway, by this all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Now, that statement right there and the connection between discipleship and love, that is unique to John. I don't mean that Jesus' words, love one another, aren't in the other Gospels. They're there. But this becomes the obsession with John. In all of his writings, this is not just in his Gospel. Well, maybe the book of Revelation, you find it in spots. But definitely his letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, he's all about the love side of this. And yet, this is the one who was saying, you know, call down fire from heaven. You know, call down fire from heaven on which group? Which people group? The Samaritans. Well, the Samaritans didn't have the right theology. They denied David. They denied the whole Davidic covenant. They weren't looking for a son of David Messiah. They were looking for a prophet like Moses. Because for them, it's just the first five books. They're heretics, right? So heretics should just deserve the fire from heaven. And especially when they reject Jesus. Why is it that John, the only gospel, includes in John chapter 4, Jesus with a Samaritan woman? And also, why does this take place? The disciples, when they come back from looking for food, they notice that he's speaking with her, and they say, why is he speaking with a woman? And this isn't just any location. They're going through Samaria. The very beginning of the chapter, I take my Greek students through this, so I know the passage fairly well. I usually, second semester, we go through this passage because it has so much theology in it. But at the very beginning, it says that it was necessary for them to go through Samaria. And if you look at the way Jews operated with the Samaritans, it wasn't necessary for them to go through Samaria. All they had to do was cross the Jordan which in spots is not difficult, and then walk around Samaria and then come back in. So whether you're going north or south, you can avoid Samaria. But it said it's necessary. In Greek, it is necessary to go through Samaria. The only thing that would make that necessary is Jesus' mission, and his mission specifically to this outsider group. But if I'm one of those who's zealous for the truth and zealous for, these people don't deserve this, then I'm not going to pay any attention to that. But John includes that connection with the Samaritan woman. In fact, when he's writing this gospel, it starts with truth. There is no question about that. The prologue, you can't get, the light shining in the darkness. We are talking about truth here. But there is another aspect to that light, and that it is a light that also is just flowing with love as well. And so truth and love can coexist. Let me see. Is that the passage that, yes, let's come over to 15, because this emphasizes it even more in 15. You know chapter 15 from I am the vine, you are the branches, you know that. But here in verse 12 of chapter 15, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. And then here we have greater love. Preempted myself. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. Now, your theological wheels should be turning there in saying that the only way that we can do what's commanded of us is to first experience a change. And the change can only take place if God demonstrates grace and love to us. So the love precedes the commands, even though it sounds like it's going the other way. First we obey, and then God loves us. No, no, no. The love comes first, the change takes place, and then the obedience to the commands. You know, John's also the one who says this in 1 John. I think it's in chapter 5, but he says that his commands are not burdensome. How can commands not be burdensome? For us, in our sinful state, commands are always burdensome. If I tell you do this, immediately in our sinful state, I don't want to do that now. You know, you try reverse psychology on some people. You know that they should be doing this, and you just tell them don't do it, and then they'll do it. You can do things like that, but there's something in us that commands are a problem. And yet, John says they're not a burden. Why? Because love is preceding those commands. I actually have a motivation when somebody shows love to me that I will follow them. Faithfulness comes from that motivation. It doesn't just come from, I'm God, I will tell you what to do. Okay? People will interpret even the Old Testament that way, and that is not the Old Testament. The Old Testament, what is it that he does at the very beginning of the Ten Commandments? Exodus chapter 20. He says, I am Yahweh, I am the Lord who delivered you out of Egypt. Then he gives the commands. We ignore that front part, and I don't know why. In Judaism, that's actually the first command. I know that's weird. They combine two other commands, but they still have 10. But the first command is to know that God delivered you. They get it right, we get it wrong, actually, on that case. Now, not in their practice. I'm just saying that's the motivation. And it's the critical thing. Okay, so verse 15, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you so that you will love one another. Don't miss the so that. usually when I teach grammar, usually Greek or Hebrew, I really focus on those purpose statements. Why? Especially the so that. I command you these things so that you will love one another. All the commands that he is giving to his disciples are ultimately for the purpose of the love. The love is actually the goal of the whole thing, which I can take you into the Old Testament and show you that's exactly how Deuteronomy should be read as well. People always think it's just a bunch of commands. Pay close attention to the so that clauses. Pay very close attention to why the commands are being given and why he is pulling a community together. It is so that they will demonstrate something that no other people group will have, something that makes them unique. Leviticus 19, be holy as I am holy. The rest of the chapter is all about loving one's neighbor. Actually, more than that, it's loving foreigners too, because when they come in, you treat them well too. You actually love them more than yourself or as yourself. But anyway, all that's in there. So holiness, uniqueness of God's people is the love. Now, the more I talk about love, the more the group that I told you about, that I grew up with, a lot of them, would say, you're talking about love, you must be compromising the truth. That's the attitude. You're not contending for the truth if you are talking about love. Because immediately to say that you love someone means that you're compromising somehow. If that person doesn't match everything that they are supposed to be, either in their lives or in their theology. Okay, so John is going from the rigid zeal and intolerance being transformed to talk about love more than anyone else. And it's so critical that we catch the disciple whom Jesus loved. He never refers to himself as John. He refers to himself that way. Why? Because he is so overwhelmed with the love that God has for him. Knowing the way he is, you know, I always say sanctification is getting to know yourself better as well as the Lord. You know just how rebellious your own heart is. And the further you go in your sanctification, the more you realize just how much of an enemy of God you are in that sin nature. And the more he pours out grace, the more you realize he is loving the unlovable. He's loving the one that does not deserve the love, which is what grace is all about. One of the things I was telling the people who were criticizing me for coming to this church, you know, I said, they talk about grace. Well, grace is compromise. I mean, if that's all they talk about. I said, that's not all they talk about. But that's critical. It's critical to understand that. All right. I want to jump into, one other thing. Since we're in 15, you're still in 15, right? Come to the end of that chapter before we go into 1 John. I want you to notice where the truth is coming from. Okay, I said that he never sacrifices truth for the sake of love. Notice this, chapter 15, verse 26. But when the Helper comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, notice how he identifies him, the Spirit of Truth, who proceeds from the Father, he will bear witness about me. And you also will bear witness because you have been with me from the beginning. Those words will come back in 1 John, from the beginning. This is how we understood him. If the Holy Spirit is the Spirit of Truth, then how is it that my doctrine and that my understanding is corrected, is fixed? If I have a bad theology or I have bad morals or bad ethics or bad all sorts of other things, what's going to fix that? Well, it's not any reformation on my part. I can't do that. I feel like the group that is so zealous for the truth that they don't want to have compassion, they want people to fix themselves before they can be accepted into the community. I have a friend who he definitely has a gift of evangelism, but we've been all over the world together in different parts of the world, Israel, Africa. We went to Canada once. In Canada, very post-Christian, hard to get any conversation going. You're trying to get a conversation going. Now, when they find out you're Protestant, they hate Catholics, so usually that works. But nonetheless, it's just they don't want anything to do with Christianity anymore. And we're walking down, he and I are just walking. We set our students in pairs and sent them off to do the same thing. You know, find people to just have conversations with. You don't drive the gospel down their throat. What you want to do is just try to find out where they are. And, you know, we're giving them all this advice on how to, you know, get an evangelistic conversation going. But we were walking along, and this friend of mine also ran a homeless shelter for years. So anyhow, he's especially connected to the homeless. We saw a homeless man sitting outside of a restaurant and looking in bad shape. And, you know, my tendency is, well, let's just, yeah, okay, let's keep walking. That's all right. And of course, my friend looked at me and he said, hang on a second. And he went up to him, spent some time with him, and he came back to me and he said, let's go on in this restaurant. I'm going to get him some food. So he brought the guy into the restaurant. Oh my goodness, that was an issue. Why are you bringing him in? He is my guest. That's what he kept saying. He's my guest. I'm buying him food. And he sat him down, and then he had a conversation with him, led him to Christ. But I know that for us is the goal. But the issue is that compassion. And yet, I can tell you, this friend of mine is no compromiser of truth. He's stricter on some things than I am. Incredibly strong on the truth. But when it comes to compassion, he understands how that works. The Spirit of truth, God's Holy Spirit, is the one that will keep us firmly entrenched. And, you know, sometimes the truth requires us to have a proper understanding of grace and love. One of the things that did attract me to this church was that is part of the truth. Okay, just a couple things. I know I'm getting to the end of time, of my time, but 1 John, well, I just either closed that thing out or, all right. 1 John 3, all you're going to do here is just hear the same words we just heard once again. But if you read 1 John, you'll see the focus of John is just what we were looking at in chapter 15 of John. And really, that upper room setting and what Jesus was teaching after Judas left. Verse 23 of chapter 3, 1 John, and this is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another. I want you to see the juxtaposition of the two words, sorry for the big word, the connection between the belief. Believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ. There's truth. And love one another. There's love. So the two together. Just as he commanded us, whoever keeps his commandments abides in God, and God in him, and by this we know that he abides in us by the Spirit whom he has given us. That was the same Spirit of truth we were just told about. Come to two books that we rarely look at, 2 John. 2 John, it's only one chapter. So 2 John, verse 1. The elder to the elect lady and her children, and I want you to notice the phrase, whom I love in truth. And not only I, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. If you ever think that he's compromised truth for the sake of love, take a look at that. But also notice that love and truth are put together. Come to the next little letter of his. 3 John, tiniest book in our New Testament. The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Putting the two together. Only one of the disciples who focuses so much attention on love, but never loses the concept of truth. So for James, ambition, perhaps both of them, but John, intolerance, changed into love. To me, that's the most radical transformation. That's much more radical than Peter. Peter, it needs to be honed in. But with John, this is a radical change. This is an understanding of the gospel that really should permeate all of us, because the gospel is not just the words and the doctrines. Actually, the foremost doctrine is God's love for us as sinners, right? The combination of that. And so our love for others as sinners is critical. I could keep preaching this, but I won't. I'm done. Yeah, go ahead.
I can relate to that.